I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, President Obama stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial where 50 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech. At a ceremony commemorating the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, Obama paid homage to King and to the spirit of ordinary people who used nonviolent resistance, boycotts, voter registration drives, and other smaller marches in the struggle for justice and racial equality.
And because they kept marching, America changed. Because they marched, the civil rights law was passed. Because they marched, a voting rights law was signed. Because they marched, doors of opportunity and education swung open so their daughters and sons could finally imagine a life for themselves beyond washing somebody else's laundry or shining somebody else's shoes. Because they marched, city councils changed, and state legislatures changed, and Congress changed, and yes, eventually the White House changed. Because they marched, America became more free and more fair, not just for African Americans, but for women and Latinos, Asians and Native Americans. For Catholics, Jews, and Muslims, for gays, for Americans with disabilities. America changed for you and for me.
We asked Eric Deggans to join us today on Radio Times to talk about yesterday's tribute, Obama's speech, and media coverage then and now. Eric is joining NPR as TV critic after many years as TV and media critic at the Tampa Bay Times. Wrote a book not so long ago called Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And Eric Deggans, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let me quote something that you wrote in the feed. That's something you write for the Tampa Bay Times. You begin, "The most amazing and overlooked aspect of today's commemoration of the March on Washington is how universally admired the event is today," I guess compared to 50 years ago?
Yeah. One of the things, I also guest hosted CNN's Reliable Sources media analysis show on Sunday, and one of the things we talked about with reporters who covered the civil rights movement at that time was that in the lead up to the March on Washington, a lot of the establishment's institutions, including the media, expected it to devolve into a huge riot. And one reason why there was so much media coverage of the march, besides the fact that it drew a unique crowd to the mall, was the fear that Washington was going to be sort of plunged into this horrific cross-racial riot. And when that didn't happen, the cameras and the journalists instead sort of documented this scene of cross-racial protests demanding equal rights for people of color, which was an amazing display.
Well, it's interesting also to compare 50 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. called the most dangerous Negro, and it seems today that he is loved by most everybody.
Well, like I pointed out in the piece, the feed is a blog that I do for the Tampa Bay Times website. It's at tampabay.com if anybody wants to check it out. And what I said in that piece is basically America loves to look back at moments when we made the right decision. So we love to look back on World War II because we were on the side of right there and opposing Hitler. And we like to look back on the civil rights movement and those moments when America sort of had the scales fall from their eyes and realized that civil rights leaders like Dr. King were fighting a just fight. But if you think about how he was regarded at the time, J. Edgar Hoover was running the FBI. He was convinced that Martin Luther King was a communist. He was denounced as a socialist by many people who were afraid of his message of economic empowerment for poor people and the Poor People's Campaign that he was about to start to try and reduce and stamp out poverty that was unfortunately hampered by his assassination. So people today don't understand how afraid a lot of people were of his message back then. And, you know, again, on CNN, we had Paul Delaney, a reporter from the Atlanta Daily World, a black newspaper in Atlanta, and he said that newspaper was very hesitant to cover the civil rights movement before the March on Washington because they were concerned that it might be rabble-rousing as well.
I'm curious, I don't know whether you watched Fox and or MSNBC yesterday, but it'd be interesting to...
little as possible.
on both of those channels, Eric?
Well, you know, I'm really disappointed at the partisan way in which the commemoration has sort of been cast on both channels. Of course, if you read my writing, I'm politically liberal, you know, obviously, and I'm an advocate for civil rights. So I'm going to be more in tune with MSNBC's message. But what I want from media, I want honest brokers. I don't want people who are going to present a message and ignore facts or twist facts or change how they present things just to make their argument stronger. So I'm not a big fan of either one of those channels at times, although I think what Fox News has done in talking about the MLK anniversary, the March on Washington anniversary, and some of these recent incidents of cross-racial crime, I think, are particularly troubling.
You also write in this piece, The Feed, that you have your own dream, of a media that creates a place where people can talk honestly about race. I mean, it seems this is a country that's had a difficult time having this large conversation, but you think the media can and should do this?
I think it's imperative that we have places in media where we teach America how to talk about this stuff in a way that is constructive and builds bridges. And the problem is that right now the biggest platforms where there are conversations about social issues and about government is cable news. And these cable news outlets have a vested interest in drawing a particular type of viewer. So on MSNBC, they're targeting liberals, they're targeting people of color, they're targeting a slightly younger audience. At Fox News, they're targeting an older audience. It's more often male. It's conservative. So they have a message that they're putting out, and they're framing their arguments and their discussions in order to reflect the worldview of those viewers that they want. But the problem is that to have a really good conversation about these issues, you have to be open-minded. You have to allow that people who disagree with you might have a good point. You have to be willing to open yourself up and take a chance and extend a hand to people who might slap it away or might criticize you. And that's the polar opposite of how these cable news channels have discussions. And that is what bothers me the most. In my book, Race Baiter, I have a section where I talk about some recommendations, some tips on how to have these kinds of conversations. And you can't let one person own these issues. So when Bill O'Reilly steps up and says, hey, I'm going to tell you how we should be talking about race in this country, well, part of it is you don't get to own this issue. And I would say that to Al Sharpton, too. You don't get to own this issue either. People of color have too often been seen as, well, race issues are their issues. But point of fact, these problems that we have with race affect everyone. And we found even in the 60s, when white people controlled the government and controlled American society, they were being limited by segregation. They were being kept from contact with people who were amazing and extraordinary. They were seeing American society limited by the fact that really great athletes and really great people who might achieve in business or people who might achieve in government were being kept out of jobs because of the color of their skin. So everybody loses when racial issues continue unabated and we don't know how to talk about this stuff. And I'm afraid that these channels in particular are just perpetuating this combative mindset that make it really hard to extend a hand and have a sensitive conversation.
I was watching a TED Talk that you gave, and you said in this talk that we're supposed to have about race, you say white folks get defensive and black folks get mad.
Yeah, the essential struggle, and I talked about it in this blog post again, is over the idea of whether institutional prejudice and racism continue to limit people of color. I think the modern day civil rights struggle is a focus on trying to root out these dynamics that we have in the criminal justice system, in the voting system, in the economic system, that result in these outcomes where people of color, black people especially, still earn 75% of what a white person who's just like them earns, who have significantly worse health outcomes, who are significantly more likely to be jailed, significantly more likely to be murdered. And unraveling that is not just about personal choice and not just about rebuilding the black family. It's also about addressing how police intersect with people of color, how the criminal justice system intersects with people of color, who gets voting rights and who doesn't, who gets to keep their voting rights after they've made a mistake and have gone to jail. All of these questions are important. And I think what we have is a sort of elemental fight over whether the playing field is level enough that everybody should be able to succeed, or whether institutions still have to deal with prejudice and stereotypes and an unfairness towards people of color. And all of these fights sort of come back to that. And I think conservatives are on one side saying the playing field is even, and there's this quote-unquote racial grievance industry where people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are making money by complaining all the time. And then there's people on the other side saying, look at how voting rights are being changed. Look at how disproportionately people of color were hammered by the recession. Look at the crime that some areas where people of color most often live are just plunged into. Look at stop and frisk laws. There's something going on here that is not just about personal choice, and that's the war that we're having in media right now.
Well, I'm about a minute or so before I have to say goodbye, and I apologize for asking this question at the very end, but do you think President Obama is in a position to talk about this, or do you think the fact that he is African-American limits his ability to talk about race?
No, I think the fact that his political opponents and supporters have different expectations for him because he's a person of color, I think that's what makes it hard for him. Whenever he gets out and tries to talk about race, I don't know, I haven't looked at recent numbers, but back when he talked about Henry Louis Gates and how the Harvard professor was arrested in his home, African-American mm-hmm. Harvard professor arrested in his home by police, his unfavorables went up with white people. When he talks about race, often his unfavorables go up with white people. It's hard for him to talk about race and still look like everybody's president. I can't wait to read the book that he writes when he gets out of the White House, because he's written very clearly and evocatively about race, and I really hope he does it again. And I've said in public forums, and I'll say it here, I'm happy to help with that book.
Oh, yeah?
If he needs a ghostwriter.
I don't think he does, Eric, but that's okay.
but I do think that's why he can't really talk about race in the way that some of us want him to, because he has to be everybody's president. And there are political enemies out there. I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting was said that he wanted to talk about Henry Louis Gates, but he was responding to a question at a press conference. So we ask him questions, he talks about race, and then he gets slammed for it. So.
Well, on that note, Eric Diggins, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. We have David K. Johnson waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about the IRS. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Cinedime, presenting Short Term 12, starring Brie Larson as a social worker in a home for at-risk teens whose secrets may cost her everything she loves. In theaters Friday, shortterm12.com.
PRI's The World brings you voices from around the globe.
I never felt, that being Muslim and being an Indian are two different things. I can't.
It's your daily source for international news and a gateway to cultures beyond our borders.
When we say somewhere over the rainbow, it's here. It's in Buenos Aires.
I'm Marco Werman. Join me right here for the next edition of The World. Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, we'll have the latest on Syria. British Prime Minister David Cameron calls Parliament back for a special session to debate military action.
What we've seen in Syria are appalling scenes of death and suffering because of the use of chemical weapons, and I don't believe we can let that stand.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. Brick Simple LLC supports WHYY. Serving Fortune 500s to startups, Brick Simple provides technology consulting and app development for the web, iPhone, iPad, Android, and Google Glass. More at BrickSimple.com.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Just a few months ago, the Obama administration was being compared to the Nixon White House, and allegations that the IRS was singling out conservative groups for extra scrutiny was being compared to the Watergate scandal. Representative Daryl Issa held a series of high-profile and contentious Judiciary Committee hearings. Even President Obama vowed to hold the responsible parties accountable. We were curious about what happened to this story that consumed so much of Washington. So we called up David K. Johnson to talk about how this story unfolded and what the politicians and media got right and what they got wrong. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, covers the U.S. economy, author of Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And David K. Johnson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you, Marty. It's nice to be back with you.
Nice to have you back with us. And let me give out the phone number to our listeners, which is 1-888-477-9499. David, this may not be covered by the quote-unquote mainstream media, but it seems that this is still a story that is alive among conservatives.
Oh, it certainly is. And the unfortunate part about it is that a totally skewed, factually baseless understanding of that has been spread by Fox News, or faux news, as I call it, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, the National Review, and other organizations. It's just totally fact-free and displays an astonishing lack of understanding of law, how government works, or even regard for the available public record.
But, and I do want to pick up on all of that, but do you think the fact that this is a story that is in many ways disappeared does a disservice to what you just said there?
Well, all of the criticisms I've just made apply to the mainstream press as well. The coverage of this is just appalling. I write a column for the Columbia Journalism Review critiquing the mainstream press coverage of fiscal and other money issues involving the government, and the coverage of this in the mainstream press has been awful, starting with the misuse of the verb target, which means to attack. There's no attack here by anybody. This whole quote-unquote scandal is really about a 1959 regulation that violates the law and about IRS agents led by a self-described conservative Republican faced with the problem of people in their applications declaring that they should be examined. I mean, think about a building inspector. You want to put up a building, Marty, and the building inspector looks at your plans and goes, we have problems with this. We don't think this building will stand up. It doesn't look safe to us. Is he attacking you, or is he doing his job?
Well, let me go back and even go back to an article you wrote just a couple of months ago titled The Other IRS Scandal. You say, and we're talking about a law, I guess it's about 100 years old, but you talk about the Supreme Court's ruling and the 2010 ruling, Citizens United, how this kind of sparked all the controversy and allegations that have roiled over the last couple of months.
Yeah, let me go back to the beginning of this.
Sure.
In 1913, we got the modern income tax with the 16th Amendment taking effect. This raised the issue of, can you have an organization that is not for profit? And in fact, we've had a corporate income tax since 1909. And so back then, chambers of commerce and other business groups often supported civic leagues and good government groups, you know, places that advocated for flowers in the park and things like that. And in the 1950s, a question arose. Well, if we are a civic improvement organization, that's what the section of the law this is all about, Section 501(c)(4) of the tax code.
Right.
If we're a civic improvement organization, and let's say our goal is we want more flowers in city parks, if we go to the city council and testify in favor of more flowers in city parks, are we violating our obligation to be exclusively for the promotion of social welfare? So the IRS in 1959 issued a regulation that said organizations engaged exclusively in the promotion of social welfare are so engaged if they primarily are engaged in the promotion of social welfare, which completely changed the meaning of the law. Along comes Citizens United, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2010 that essentially said artificial entities, corporations, unions, et cetera, may spend as much money as they can afford to influence elections. Well, some smart political entrepreneurs looked at this and said, oh, well, we've been doing this through something called 527 organizations. Those are nonprofit, but we have to tell people who donated to us. But if we could get the IRS to let us do it through 501c4 civic improvement organizations, we don't have to identify the donors, provided that only 49.99% of the money is spent on political action. By the way, the biggest and best known of these groups, Carl Rhodes, Crossroads GPS, filed a tax return for, I think it was the year 2011, showing that 99.99%, I kid you not, 99.99% of their money was spent not for social betterment. And so now comes along these groups, left and right, that apply to the IRS for status as 501c4s, which will allow them to hide their donors but spend unlimited amounts of money under the 2010 Citizens United decision.
Let me just jump in here, because what you're really saying is, and this goes back to 1959, we're putting some of this into historical context, it really has to do with two words, from the word exclusively to the word primarily. And by going from operate exclusively for the promotion of social welfare to primarily, that opened the floodgates for these groups.
Well, and then nobody really particularly cared about that, because small amounts of money were spent by groups for these incidental purposes until Citizens United. Now, the IRS website has two important things anybody can go look up on their own. Number one, it says in the IRS regulations and in their plain English language version that engagement in political campaigns is not social improvement. It is not civic betterment. That's political campaigns.
Right.
Secondly, just as important, the IRS went after.
Oh, I think we seem to have lost our guest temporarily. Hopefully, we're hanging on every word. David K. Johnston, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And we called him up because we wanted to catch up on this so-called IRS scandal. And I don't know what happened to you, David, but apparently you're back.
I'm back.
Okay.
The second thing that happened here is that the only groups the IRS has denied or revoked their tax-exempt status for political involvement in were Democratic progressive organizations. Hmm. In fact, you do not need the IRS's permission to be a 501c4. You can simply go into business, and as long as you file your 990 tax return that all nonprofits file, except religious ones, you can just self-declare. But a number of the groups, particularly groups with names like Tea Party, filled out applications, because they put them out on the web, that screamed, we're not really a social betterment organization, a civic improvement organization, we're a political organization. And so the IRS officials charged with determining, they're called the determination unit, whether you qualify for this privilege of tax-exempt status. Turns out they're so apolitical they didn't even know what the Tea Party was. One of these guys took to his boss, who's testified about it, examples that troubled him, and his boss looked at this, and in the break room, the TV came on with a story, I believe on Fox News, maybe in one of the other cable channels, about the Tea Party that suddenly put this in focus, and the guy said, we're going to have to look at all of these, because these don't appear to qualify. And so they simply, for shorthand, and this is wrong to do this, but for shorthand, they picked any organization that had a name like Tea Party. But it turns out they also picked names like Progressive, names that suggested you were a successor to the Acorn organization. That is, they looked at everybody who appeared to be political, whether they were right or left.
Let me just reintroduce you, and that's David K. Johnston, our guest in this portion of Radio Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He covers the U.S. economy, and he has been covering what we're calling the so-called IRS scandal that was so much in the news not so long ago, and we wanted to find out what happened to this story and talk about what we have learned along the way, what the media, what the politicians got right and what they got wrong. And again, we're taking phone calls. Any questions or comments? That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And David, what happened is the Cincinnati office of the IRS, they were the people that had to sign off on those 501c4 applications.
Right. Now, you can apply to the IRS to get approval, but that doesn't mean you can't just go ahead. It says right on the IRS website, you don't have to get approval. So any group that goes around now saying, as a number of the Tea Party groups have, the White House was interfering with us, nonsense. First of all, the IRS is an independent agency. Everybody involved has testified there's been no involvement by anybody outside of the bureaucrats at the IRS. Absolute clear testimony about that. So how did this story get so long?
Yeah.
Well, there's a Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration named J. Russell George, who's generally done a pretty good job. But he is a former Republican political operative. He worked for Bob Dole, among others. And he was asked by Daryl Issa, a Republican who is the head of this investigating committee, to look into the denial of or delays in approving, because there were no denials, 501c4 applications by Tea Party groups. And he did exactly that. He didn't look into everybody's denials or delays. He only looked at the groups ISA asked him to look about, and then he wrote a report about it. And here's where the IRS executive in charge, a woman named Lois Lerner, who's a lawyer, completely messed up, and I was the first person to call for her resignation.
I noticed that.
And what happened is, instead of saying, when they're given an advanced copy of the Inspector General's report, excuse me, Inspector General, you've looked at a narrow segment of this and completely misconstrued what we were doing and put it in a political context. In fact, we were doing this to everybody who applied who appeared to be political. We didn't care what their politics were. We just said, we need to scrutinize you. Instead, she did this bizarre thing of going to a meeting of the American Bar Association tax section in Washington and having a planted question asked so she could get the news out about this ahead of the Inspector General's report. It's indicative mm-hmm. of her rank incompetence, I believe if she had a shred of decency, she would resign. Instead, she's on paid leave and may well be there for a couple of years until they can get around to firing her, even though she's not a rank-and-file civil service person. She's an executive.
But what's interesting, and perhaps this is why this story took off, which is that it took a month or two before other documents were revealed showing that the IRS was also looking at, as you said, groups that had the word blue or progressive or occupy or words that would be associated with progressive or liberal causes.
That's true, but it's also indicative of two other big problems going on in our society. One is that the number of journalists has shrunk dramatically. There's been about a one-third decline in the number of reporters in this country in the last 13 years. Philadelphia, where you are, according to Pew, had 260-some reporters at various institutions covering the city, and now it's down to about less than 50. The second is that there has been a concerted effort to turn journalists into stenographers. Aaron Sorkin's show, The Newsroom, keeps making this point. I've been making it for years that tough questions get you in trouble. And when I'm also the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, which has 4,300 members across the country. And when I give lectures to young journalists about how to ask questions, many of them say that if they were to ask the questions I'm saying, say, wait a minute, Senator, that's simply not true. You said X, or somehow impeaching the witness or asking tough questions, that you'd be fired today. And I believe that. I mean, I know examples of reporters who simply asked tough questions and were fired for it. So the press is not doing its job, which is to be skeptical and aggressive.
But I also wonder, with a story like this where the facts, it takes a while for the facts to come out, whether then the press should sort of hold off until they know everything, or, you know, how far out on a limb do you go on a story with incomplete information? And especially when we're talking about a tax code, which is a very complicated document to try to understand.
Well, you know, right off the bat, Lawrence O'Donnell, who has a show on MSNBC and used to be the chief of staff for the Senate Finance Committee, that is the chief tax writing committee in the Senate, got onto this, and I was out with my column about the same issue, I think, one day after him. Print takes a little longer than television these days.
I know this.
And yet, other journalists, they didn't cite us. They didn't refer to this. They stuck with the official narrative. They dealt with the talking points. They quoted what they were told without questioning what was going on. And all you had to do was go look up the regulations, which are right in the public record. Any competent reporter should know how to look up government regulations. Unfortunately, an astonishing number don't, and an astonishing number are innumerate.
So is the story...
They're literate, but they're not numerate.
Numerate meaning that they don't understand numbers.
Numbers. Right. And very few reporters, frankly, understand how the administration of government works. What we're getting from Washington is coverage of politics, not government. And it's government that affects your life much more than anything else.
So as the story stands today, from your perspective, and it's one of the reasons we called you up, is that there were many, many more applications for this 501c4 tax exemption. The Cincinnati office got overwhelmed. They put people into categories so that they could sign off or on whether they got a tax exemption or not. Yes?
That's right. And this is a minor backwater at the IRS, which is already a backwater agency. And they were flooded with these requests over a period of time, and they really didn't know what to do with them. And some good guidance came from, of all people, Lois Lerner, except she didn't then follow up and make sure they did everything, which is an example of, frankly, her incompetence.
Well, you talk about cuts in the media and the fewer number of reporters. Is that also true for the IRS?
Well, that's the other scandal. We have stripped and stripped and stripped the IRS to the point where there's blatant cheating going on in a number of categories and nothing is being done about it. My column at Tax Analysts, which is a nonprofit publisher, I constantly focus on this issue. The IRS per capita has had its budget cut, I think it's 13% in real terms in the last decade. They simply cannot do the job that we have assigned to them. And remember, the Congress, particularly at the behest of conservative Republicans, has turned the IRS into a welfare agency. It has the earned income tax credit. There are a whole series of other tax credits, many of which benefit very wealthy people, that it is now directed to administer. And yet it doesn't have the budget to do so. And it's only this year, maybe, that they will finally give up their legacy computer system, which was designed when Eisenhower was president and put in place when John F. Kennedy was the president, and uses software that is the IT equivalent of speaking Latin.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. I'm trying to digest all that. David K. Johnston, our guest today on Radio Times. I guess I'm laughing to keep from crying. We're talking about the IRS story that consumed so much of Washington, so much of the media just a couple of months ago. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He covers the U.S. economy, has covered our tax system as well. And again, any questions or comments, I'm sure you covered the story and followed this story, we'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by Pennsylvania College of Health Sciences. Applications are being accepted for an online Bachelor of Science in Health Sciences program beginning spring 2014. More information online at pacollege.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, our late-night series continues with Jimmy Fallon. To prepare for his own talk show, he practiced interviewing his mother.
She kept wanting to cut to a clip, and we have no clip. She's not in a movie. She's my mother.
Fallon will become the new host of The Tonight Show after Jay Leno steps down early next year. Jimmy Fallon on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
You're on camera everywhere you go, but with computers, you may never have to show ID. Within seconds, you can be matched with your personal data.
Officers match photos of suspects or from security cameras with the driver's license records.
The law and the growing capability of facial recognition technology. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, NextRE, a technology-driven real estate brokerage featuring properties in the tri-state area on NextRE.com. Agents are equipped with marketing tools designed to enhance their production.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, our guest is Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter David K. Johnston. And we called him up because we were curious about what happened to the so-called IRS scandal that was a top news story just a few months ago. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. David, I'm sure a lot of people are not crying when they learn that the IRS budget has been cut 13%. I mean, it's an agency that people have little regard for, shall we say. Do we have him? No, we don't seem to have him. All right, we're going to try to call him back up. And
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Come through. Marty, they should, and here's the reason.
Sure.
When the IRS budget gets cut, wage earners are still fully taxed. You and I get taxed on our paycheck. The money comes out of our taxes. Our taxes come out of our paycheck before we get our money. But lots of people in America self-report, and there is no check on them except the IRS. And to the extent that those people, many of whom make, I kid you not, billion-dollar annual incomes, as I've documented extensively from the public record, billion-dollar annual incomes and pay no taxes, legally or in some cases illegally, they should care. Because if other people escape the burden of taxes that you and I have to bear, we can't even collect our money without paying our taxes, then we suffer from that. We get less government services, and other people get a free ride. And so we should care a lot about equal enforcement of the laws.
Even looking at our tax system, and it seems in many ways, because it is so many pages long and so complicated, that is often used for political benefit, it seems.
Oh, it is. I mean, one of the biggest and most important trends going on in the United States is that while we all talk about this welfare system that was radically cut by President Clinton and Congress back in 1995, what we have today is a system to redistribute money upwards. I've documented, for example, how a major industry, the pipeline industry, got itself exempted from the corporate income tax in 1986. Okay, so they got themselves exempted from it. But then, during the George W. Bush administration, they got in a regulation that requires you and I, every time we turn on the stove to boil water or we put gas in our car, to pay them not just the corporate income tax on their profits, but what's called the grossed-up corporate income tax. That's not the 35% tax, it's 54%. So we pay that money to them, billions of dollars a year, and they keep it. It doesn't go to government. And all across the country, we are handing out at state and local government levels a minimum of $70 billion a year. That's almost $1,000 for a family of four in giveaways to the biggest companies in America. We are destroying local entrepreneurial businesses and allowing major chains to expand and grow because your tax dollars are being used to benefit those people at the expense of everyone else. And unfortunately, you know, there's a handful of us out there who are documenting this, even though it's right in the public record. It's not being covered by the mainstream media except now and then occasionally and then in ways that don't have any impact.
Well, and even going back to the 501c4s, I read recently that Representative Chris Van Hollen has sued or is considering suing the IRS and wants to prevent these social welfare organizations from engaging in political activity, which is sort of at the heart of the matter here. Do you think he has a chance of getting this enacted?
Well, I don't know how he'll do with the lawsuit. He and some other groups that 2 years ago first complained about these 501c4s. are going to pursue a court strategy. But the Internal Revenue Service did, in its latest announcement of their major paperwork and regulatory objectives for the coming year, include 501c4 regulations.
Mm.
So they are going to try. On the other hand, those people like Daryl Issa, who are beating up the IRS, they have made it clear they're in favor of secret campaign money, and they're probably, you know, there's a possibility they'll get a law passed that says, you know, 501c4s, doors wide open, you can spend dark money. I think this is a far from settled issue.
And one wonders, I guess, once a provision like this is enacted, whether you can, in a sense, put that genie back in the bottle. And by that, I mean, I was looking at the presidential campaign of last year. Something like $256 million was spent by these 501c4 groups.
Yes. And there is, so long as they are allowed to operate without disclosing who their donors are, they're going to be incredibly popular with those people who want to influence what you know and therefore what you vote, but don't want to be exposed. You know, at least you can say for the local newspaper, you know who owns it, you know what their positions are, they have signed articles, shouldn't have positions, they should just have reporting, but you have signed columns where you are allowed to take a position, and editorials that the editor of the paper and the publisher are responsible for. But this is completely dark money, and it's a very narrow group of people who are financing these things. So they're getting a disproportionate voice.
That's, again, David K. Johnston, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We've been having some phone problems, clearly. Looks like we have cleaned them up. And any questions or comments, do give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Feels like the computer system that the IRS has been using for decades now. But, David, what do you think, then, if there are lessons from this whole IRS story, what do you think, though, that lesson is? And whether it has to do with media coverage or whether it has to do with the political system or even for the public?
Well, I think there's a whole series of lessons here. One of them is that we need to pay attention to how our tax agency works. After all, we live in the Second American Republic. The First American Republic failed, and it failed because it didn't have the power to tax. A government that can't tax is a government that has no authority. And so we need to pay very close attention to the tax system. I don't expect every American out there to do so, but those institutions that do focus on it, like tax analysts, people need to pay more attention to the work that they do. Secondly, it's a lesson about how the inspector general process can be politicized. And in this case, clearly this was a political deal because they only looked at how Tea Party type groups were affected, not at how all groups were affected by the action of the IRS. And then I think there's a very powerful lesson about what's happened to the news media in this country. Mm-hmm. We need to have journalists who are aggressive and skeptical. We don't need stenography. We need aggressive and skeptical. And facts will sort themselves out if we get that. But the road we're going down now, where reporters are cowed, and trust me, they are. I mean, I've been in the very forefront of efforts by lots of big, powerful groups and institutions to fire me when I was at the New York Times, at the Philadelphia Inquirer, at the LA Times, just for telling absolutely, solidly bolted down facts that people didn't want to hear. We need to have an aggressive, skeptical, and well-educated in how government works news media.
I wonder, too, how much you specifically blame Daryl Issa for this story, and even the White House. As I said in my introduction, you know, President Obama said we're going to hold people accountable.
Well, I think President Obama made a very serious mistake here. The IRS is an independent agency, and when he went on national TV to announce that Jack Lew had fired the commissioner of the IRS, who was about to retire anyway in a few weeks, I think that gave a completely wrong signal, and it gave fire and fuel to those people who believe the White House was interfering. And by the way, there are newspapers around the country that have run stories quoting Tea Party leaders as saying the whole purpose of this was President Obama's campaign was doing opposition research. Complete paranoid, baseless comments, but some local newspapers have run them on the front page. And so this has created this misperception of what's going on. Daryl Issa, who is perhaps the wealthiest member of Congress, he's worth $300-400 million at least, is a very partisan Republican. And remember, we have had this in Washington back when Harry Truman was president. Democrats and Republicans shared housing together. They played cards together. They did other things that men away from home do together.
Yes.
Now we have a place where Grover Norquist years ago said that bipartisanship is date rape. And if you look at the housing patterns in Washington, conservative Republicans live with conservative Republicans. Democrats live with Democrats. Mainstream or moderate Republicans live with moderate Republicans. And we don't have this focus on how do we do the best we can with this big, complex country. Instead, it's how do we gain political advantage. And it is just as bad when the Democrats do it as the Republicans. We need to have a Congress that's not focused on how to gain an advantage and make your opponent look bad, but on how do we get a well-run government. Look at ICE's hearings. He hasn't proposed anything to make the system work properly. All he's done is screamed falsely, fire.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, we're having some phone problems. Looks like they're fixed. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Jim. Jim calling us from Norristown. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I have a lot to say, but I'll try to say it real quick. I am a former IRS employee. And the first thing I want to say is the IRS is an enforcement agency, just like the DEA is, just like the FBI is. You don't hear a lot of people saying, let's cut back the FBI and stop prosecuting crime. We are an enforcement agency, but the laws that we're enforcing are financial laws. So naturally, we're unpopular because we collect money, money which, by the way, we use to run the country. But there's something called the tax gap out there. I think your guest alluded to this.
Mm-hmm.
They know that there's hundreds of billions of dollars in uncollected taxes out there. They know it's there. Why would you not increase the resources that you're devoting to go collecting that money? They know it's there. It's just a matter of collecting it.
Well,
and one quick analogy, and then,
sure.
then I'll let you go. I always analyze this, too. If you're having a corporate board meeting, and the CEO is sitting there and he says, you know, we have a real problem with brand and name recognition. We haven't been getting our word out there. What can we do to help that? And somebody raises their hand and says, I know, let's fire the marketing department. I mean, it's just the opposite of exactly what we need to do to collect the money and to try to enforce the laws. And naturally, when you're reaching into people's pockets, you're going to be unpopular.
Right.
But that's the mission of the IRS. And we have never, ever been staffed and funded to accomplish that mission.
Jim, thanks for the call.
That's all I wanted to say.
I'm glad you said it. Thanks for the call. David, go ahead.
Well, Marty, Jim is quite right. I always refer to the IRS as the tax police. The FDA are the drug and food police, and the Securities and Exchange Commission are the Wall Street police. And we have handcuffed the tax police to the benefit of the plutocrat class, not to the benefit of working people. We have rigorous enforcement of the laws for employees and wage taxes. Everybody else, as you move up the chain, less and less rigor. And why would you cut your sales or revenue department, as Jim pointed out? You should be expanding it.
Jim, thanks for the call. Let me see what Sandy from Germantown has to say. And Sandy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard during this whole brouhaha, I heard one person, Howard Dean, and I believe I heard him on NPR, but I can't be sure of that, state two interesting facts. First of all, that the numbers weren't even close. If you divided them roughly into red groups and blue groups, there was a total of 500, I'm rounding, of course, a total of 500 groups looked at, 200 of which were substantially blue. 300 were blue, 200 were red. And I was wondering if Mr. Johnson had the correct numbers for that. And the other point that Mr. Dean made in the same reporting was that this particular program was instituted by an IRS staffer who was serving a regular standard 5-year term and had been appointed by President George Bush.
Okay, so
and I just wondered if
sure.
I could, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Sandy. Go ahead, David.
Okay, well, first of all, there were about 296 groups the Inspector General looked at, and a minority of those were Tea Party-type groups. And now that we're getting fuller data, it's very clear that there was a broad range of groups here, And while it's true that some of the Tea Party type groups got more extensive questions, it seems pretty clear that's because their applications, and I go back to my building inspector analogy, their applications raised broader questions, therefore they got broader questions. And Dr. Dean, he's former Governor Dean's actually a physician, is correct when he said that all this happened while an IRS commissioner appointed by George Bush was in charge. The IRS commissioner himself had very little knowledge of this thing, however. Let's be clear. This was done by low-level people in Cincinnati. The lead executive there, the lead manager, he's not an executive, the manager there who's the crucial person in this is a self-described conservative Republican who had been there 21 years, and I think the record is eminently clear. He was being professional, and he has been wronged by ISA and his committee in awful ways. I mean, it's the equivalent of taking a detective at the Philadelphia Police Department who's done a terrific job and going after him because you didn't like the cases that he brought.
And who was this person? What's his name?
I'm sorry, don't remember.
Okay.
I've got it. I just not on the top of my head.
Not on the top of your head. We're almost out of time here, but I what's so frustrating is that the scandal, you know, the scandal gets the headlines, but the correction gets buried, you know, somewhere deep in a newspaper or in a news coverage.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been a problem in the news, but the real problem, I think, is that when this news broke, it was all done by talking points. And interestingly, the Democrats' talking points have gotten significantly less coverage. I was this morning, I'm not finished, going through the Nexus and Factiva database systems trying to do a statistical analysis, but the Democrats' corrective to the record announcements have gotten a minuscule coverage compared to the charges. And a lot of this is because not enough journalists understand how government works. They've never taken a course in public administration, and they are trained to cover politics, not government.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, David K. Johnson, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very much.
Marty.
You're very welcome. And he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He covers the U.S. economy, author of a book called Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. And do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.